24. 7:46 a.m., November 14, 2018. West Garfield Park, Chicago, Illinois. Kojo Amabo was looking for the cathedral patterns in a cherry wood board. The bearded 45-year-old homicide detective was working on another end table. This one was for his neighbors, Morris and Barbara Thompson. They'd been excellent neighbors, watching out for his place when he'd been away, and keeping an eye on his son Brandon, though they didn't need to. Neighborly was how they described themselves. He figured that went a long way in today's world, and he wanted to reward them for it. Like always, the cherry end table ended up a transitional piece. Though Kojo wasn't instinctively drawn to any contemporary style, he found his hands made simple forms. He was minimalist by nature. When he looked at the wood, he never saw complicated pieces. He saw plain, geometric shapes, mostly angled. It was not the sort of work his family would have expected. Kojo's grandfather, Echo, came from a long line of woodworkers in Aburigana. While Kojo had inherited Echo's artistic bent, he didn't get his lighter skin tone or squat nature. Kojo was dark and tall, with broad shoulders and a permanently furrowed brow. Kojo had never met his grandfather. He only knew his face from his mother's photo albums, but he grew up surrounded by Echo's work. There were masks on every wall and stools in every corner of his family home. Echo made the traditional items for the souvenir market. Aachen masks, Ashanti stools, mortars, fertility dolls, and drums. Despite being immersed in the culture, Kojo didn't come up thinking he'd make masks, dolls, or furniture. He didn't think he'd become a cop either. In high school, all the aptitude tests he took suggested he'd be an engineer or a physician. He had a thing for numbers and an intensely rational mind. His father had taken him to see The Return of the Jedi when it first came out. Kojo was 10. After the movie, his father asked him what he thought. Kojo said, "The spaceships wouldn't have really moved like that. There's no air in space." His parents were delighted and took to calling him Professor. The nickname certainly fit. Kojo had been a serious boy. Kids on the block had other nicknames for him, of course, from the innocuous Poindexter to the scalding faggot. He let them talk, not ignorant to their taunts, but not deterred either. But when he fought, which he rarely did, they got the message quick. Kojo's father had done some amateur boxing as a young man. He taught his son to always keep his hands up and head tucked. "Key to winning a fight," his father told him, "is keeping their fist from your jaw. They hit your jaw, you drop." Kojo's high school grades were good. There was even talk of college scholarships, and he was ready to take them, ready to fully dive into the white world in Wisconsin or Maine. But senior year, Kojo's mom got sick with sickle cell anemia. She went into renal failure just 2 days after his 18th birthday. She died 6 months later. Kojo's father took it badly. He drank himself into a stupor nearly every night. So Kojo spent his last year of high school taking care of the house, the meals, everything. He never went looking to be a cop. The academy came to him. There was a recruitment drive at the library. He'd been having a bad day and completed an application more out of frustrated boredom than anything else. Regardless of his attitude, he took the application seriously. Recruiters noticed he filled out every single comment box with blocks of carefully worded text. He even fixed 2 seemingly innocuous typos. First time they'd seen that since creating the new application 10 years prior. That should have been their first warning sign. In his garage, Detective Amabo found the cathedral pattern in the cherry wood board. He spun it around and started to sand it down when he heard a crash, like a pan dropping onto a kitchen floor. He turned off his sander and, listening carefully, opened the door to the detached garage. It was quiet outside, and early enough that the express ray wasn't yet choked with traffic. There were no sirens. As he stood in the doorway, looking across the street at the boarded-up windows on the old Hayter place, and wondering if the tattered pink condemnation letter would ever fall off the front door, he heard the clattering sound again. It was coming from his house. Kojo scrambled across the backyard and opened the patio door. Brandon? Another crash. This time something shattered. Shit. Kojo rushed into the kitchen to find his 12-year-old son in a rage. Brandon was a big kid, easily half of Kojo's weight, and he was putting all of it into smashing the pots and pans onto the tile floor. Seeing Kojo, Brandon began to cry.
No!
Brandon wailed. It's okay. Kojo walked over, draping an arm around his son. This is something we can fix. Not going to be a big problem, all right?
No, no, no.
His face puffy with tears and impotent rage, Brandon tried to wrench away from Kojo, but Kojo held tight, locking his hands around his son's waist. Brandon fought at first, his fists hammering down on Kojo's back. But Kojo only held him tighter. The doctors had explained that deep pressure touch sometimes helped kids with Down syndrome relax. Within seconds, Kojo could feel Brandon's racing heartbeat slow as his crying softened. His breathing normalized.
It's okay,
Kojo kept repeating. It's all gonna be okay. Brandon unwound in his father's arms, the tension dissolving away, more and more until Kojo could loosen his grip.
You cool now?
I'm cool,
Brandon said. Kojo let Brandon go. The boy slumped to the floor, and Kojo laid down beside him. He lifted up his son's chin so they could see eye to eye.
What's going on? What's got you so upset? Where's Ophelia? She's not here.
I know, son. She's on her way.
I want her here now.
Come on.
Kojo stood up and pulled Brandon up, still wobbly with emotion. The boy shuffled over to the kitchen table and sat down with a sour face. As Kojo picked up the pots and pans, he examined several cracked tiles on the floor. Not a big deal. He could replace them over the weekend.
Listen, buddy. I need for you to come find me when you need something, all right? You call me on the radio, or you come find me. We talked about this just the other day, remember?
I couldn't find the radio.
Well, it was in the living room earlier this morning. Did you look there?
Brandon shook his head.
I'm hungry.
Of course.
Kojo bristled. He wanted to throw the pot through the kitchen window. He would have loved to see it turn the pane of glass into a spiderweb before it jettisoned into the humid morning air and bounced with a tinny clang onto the driveway. Instead, Kojo placed the pot on the counter and walked over and kissed Brandon on the forehead. As he did, he closed his eyes and took in his son's scent. A mix of coconut, lotion that Ophelia put on him, sweat, and the sweet cloying smell that was unique to Brandon. It reminded Kojo of prekkis, a Ghanaian spice with a sugary, fragrant aroma that he recalled from the gingery iced tea brew his grandmother would sip on hot days.
I miss Mom. She's not coming back, is she?
Kojo cleared his throat.
No, Brandon. You know that.
She's dead is why.
Yes.
Yesterday, Brandon had begged for Constance to come back. He told Kojo he'd clean his room. He'd even clean the bathroom with a toothbrush like he saw someone do on a TV show. When Kojo reminded Brandon that his mother died 5 years ago, it took 28 minutes for Brandon to still his frustrated shaking and calm down. Kojo knew he couldn't get caught up in that loop again.
So what do you want to eat?
Brandon thought for a second as he rubbed the last tears from his eyes.
Cereal,
he said.
The loops or that other junk?
That other junk.
Kojo filled a bowl with shockingly neon-colored cereal, added skim milk, and then placed it in front of Brandon with a spoon.
Brandon reached for the spoon but paused. He looked up at Kojo and grinned.
Thank you, Dad.
Brandon's smile hit Kojo like a meteor every time he saw it. All the horrible things that had passed before his eyes. The memories that woke him screaming. The dead woman with her legs eaten to nubs by rats. The child with his hands nailed to the dinner table. The unidentifiable drowning victim with skin that sloughed off like sheets of phyllo dough. All dissolved instantly. Kojo could never envision living without that smile. While the woodworking was an effective salve for existential worries, Brandon's smile was the only true cure for Kojo's world weariness. Watching Brandon eat, Kojo poured himself a bowl of the sugary stuff and was taking his first bite when his cell phone vibrated on the kitchen counter. Kojo calmly placed the spoon back down and answered the phone.
This is Detective Omabo.
Brandon quietly repeated Kojo's words as he chewed a mouthful of cereal.
Got a 1071 at the University Hospital,
a brusque voice intoned.
Carson and Briggs are already en route, but she figured you need to be there too.
Casualties? Kojo asked.
Casualties?
Brandon said.
Several,
dispatch confirmed.
I'll head out soon.
Kojo hung up and turned to Brandon. He was already getting upset again.
Daddy has to work, B,
Kojo said, shaking his head.
I know that.
Doesn't mean I don't want to be here with you.
I know that, too.
Kojo got up and patted Brandon on the shoulder. Finish up, dude. Ophelia arrived at the house a minute later. She was a Ghanaian immigrant who had immigrated to Chicago several years earlier to be with her adult children and three grandbabies. The rest of her family, two sisters and three brothers, lived in Accra. She had told Kojo that she did not anticipate returning to Ghana to see them for many years, if ever. He told her he'd help her any way he could. At the time, she just smiled, thanked him, and said,
"You already have so much on your plate."
When Ophelia walked into the house, Brandon jumped up from his cereal and ran to her. He hugged her long and hard and told her that Kojo yelled at him about throwing the pans. Ophelia, her sing-songy accent, thick but clear, told Brandon that it wasn't good to throw pans.
"You know better than that,"
she told him. Brandon nodded, then looked back at Kojo.
"You need to get dressed proper, Dad."
25. 8:43 a.m., November 14, 2018. University of Chicago Medicine, Chicago, Illinois. Matilda watched Ashtonique tuck into her second round of pancakes.
"These are pretty good," Ashtonique said. The girl was starving. Matilda, however, couldn't take a single bite of her food. Clark's demise kept running through her head. Yet, she couldn't cry. She couldn't feel those emotions anymore. Earlier, while hospital staff ran a few tests with Ashtonique, Matilda took a moment to grieve with colleagues in one of the psychology department meeting rooms. Clark's secretary of 15 years broke down sobbing, knees buckling. Matilda calmed her, though inside she felt a spreading numbness. She knew it was trauma, too. Sometimes the body can be in such a state of emotional siege that it chooses to shut down, to conserve resources like tears and breath. Sitting in that near-empty meeting room, Matilda thought, "This is what it means to move on. This is how a heart becomes hardened." Ashtonique took a break to chew, then swallow, before she asked, "What did the cops mean when they said I was poisoned?" Matilda didn't realize Ashtonique had been conscious during the events following the incident in the pharmacy. After security had arrived and shuttled Matilda and Ashtonique to safety, they were taken across the building to the ER, where doctors pumped Ashtonique's stomach. Matilda called in an oncologist she knew. She assured her the Metro chime wouldn't hurt Ashtonique, at least not in the doses she'd taken. Matilda had been assured that Ashtonique was given propofol via IV drip during the procedure. Whatever recollections the girl had, Matilda assumed,
were either figments or the drug had been ineffective. They were worried about the drug your mom gave you. They shouldn't have been, Ashanik said. She took it all the time. What do you remember after? It was gross. Matilda laughed, the stress of the morning easing. The cops came in and talked to you, Ashanik said. I heard them ask you about how you knew me, why they thought that man would be after my mom. Yes, I told them. I didn't know the reason why. But you mentioned the night doctors? I did. I thought it was important. Ashanik chewed her food in silence for a moment. I warned you, though, she said. That man in the pharmacy, was he one of them? Ashanik shrugged. Matilda sipped her coffee and then leaned back and watched people eating, milling about the cafeteria. A day ago, this place was banal. Just another unfurnished link in the averageness of her day. But the creeping unease that had settled into Matilda's gut transformed it. Now, every movement, every scrape of fork against plate, every cash register chime, raised her hackles. The world around her was newly pregnant with danger. I'm not going to have to throw this up, right? Ashanik asked. Matilda turned her attention back to the girl. No, she said. You can eat as much as you like. Your stomach feels okay? It's fine. Ashanik put her fork down. My mom's never coming back, is she? I can tell. If she were, she'd be here by now. I've been watching the doors to this room, looking at the hallway over there, thinking I might see her. But I won't. You don't know that, Matilda said. I feel it, though. Ashanik leaned to her right to look over Matilda's shoulder. Here they come again. Matilda turned around in her chair to see two uniformed police officers approaching the table. Matilda was hopeful that they had news about Janice. Maybe they'd caught Clark's killer, and she could start grinding the edges off the fear. Clark's gone, Maddie. Don't be selfish. Think about his wife, his kids. Dr. Deacon, we need you and Mrs. Walters to come with us. Sorry to interrupt your meal, but it's important we do it now. Is this about my mom? Ashanik asked. You'll need to discuss everything with the detectives. 6 minutes and two elevators later, Matilda and Ashanik found themselves in an administrative wing of the hospital. They were separated. Matilda escorted Ashanik to a meeting room where several nurses were waiting. She gave the girl a kiss on the forehead. I'll see you soon, okay? Don't worry. They're just going to ask you a few questions. Tell them everything. They only want to help. Ashanik seemed anxious to be separated from Matilda, but she went into the room without raising a fuss and sat down at the table with the nurses. They immediately moved closer to comfort her as the door closed. Matilda followed an officer to a small conference room that overlooked a parking lot. Outside of the table and chairs, the only thing in the room was a spider plant, its soil dry and cracked. The plant's leaves were yellow, blackened at the tips like they'd been burned. Matilda wished she'd had her water bottle, the one she got at a conference 2 years ago and kept under her desk. She considered getting up to bring the plant over to the bathroom, suddenly convinced she had to save it, too. When a detective stepped into the room, he sat down across from her, a cup of coffee in hand. My name is Kojo Omabo. I'm a homicide detective with Chicago PD. I was called in to get your side of what went down earlier this morning. That was a very traumatic event. You need anything? No, I'm okay. Thanks. Matilda was struck by Kojo's bearing. Unlike the dozen or so cops she'd already seen that morning, she sensed a deep-rooted worldliness to him. It wasn't just his name or his dark skin. It was his demeanor. The other officers had been visibly shaken by the attack. Matilda could sense their discomfort. They radiated nervous energy. As a psychologist, Matilda understood why,
Even people exposed to stress-inducing situations for years, decades even, can't override their body's natural inclination to downshift into the fight-or-flight response. The heart races, the skin sweats, the eyes dart. But Kojo exuded a grounded calm that was reassuring. Rather than losing himself in his anxiety, Kojo seemed to be the type of person who could step out of his own body and say, "You're anxious. Let's not be anxious." "Great," Kojo said. "Should we begin?" "Okay." Kojo placed a tape recorder on the table and pressed record. 26. In the matter of interview with Deacon Matilda, Investigative Sergeant Kojo Omabo, number 2716, Chicago Police Department, volume 1 of 2, November 14, 2018. Tape 1, 28 seconds. Kojo Omabo. "Today's date is the 14th of November, 2018. The time is 8:57 a.m. What I'd like to have done is I'm going to identify myself, and then have you tell me your name. I am Kojo Omabo, homicide with the Chicago PD. Dr. Deacon? Matilda Deacon. Matilda Deacon. Kojo Omabo. As you can obviously tell, this is being recorded. Is it okay if I call you Matilda, Dr. Deacon? Matilda Deacon. Yes. Kojo Omabo. At this particular time, do you have any medical conditions that you know of? Matilda Deacon. No, not now. Kojo Omabo. Do you take any regular medication? Matilda Deacon. Blood pressure meds. Runs in the family. I also have a prescription for Prozac. Haven't taken it in several months. Probably expired. Is this important? There was a shooting this morning. Kojo Omabo. I know. We're getting to that now. Matilda Deacon. Okay. Kojo Omabo. Are you feeling okay right now? Do you think there might be anything affecting your ability to think clearly at the moment? Matilda Deacon. Other than seeing someone I know very well have his throat cut right in front of my face? Kojo Omabo. I understand. It's a formality, Dr. Deacon. Matilda Deacon. Sorry. It's been a stressful day. Kojo Omabo. You are a professor here at the university. How long have you been teaching? Matilda Deacon. In the psychology department, it'll be 6 years. I did my graduate work here too, though. Kojo Omabo. Outside of teaching, you do research? There's a lab listed here in your file from HR. Matilda Deacon. Yes, in conjunction with the medical school. Neurology. It's basic research, nothing clinical. Kojo Omabo. But you do see patients. Says here you go to Marcy Lansing Apartments once a month. Matilda Deacon. Yes. Kojo Omabo. That's how you came to meet Ashanique Walters? Matilda Deacon. Yes. Kojo Omabo. When did you first meet her? Matilda Deacon. A day ago. I was at the apartments seeing patients with Todd. Kojo Omabo. Dr. Garcia Areas? Matilda Deacon. Yes. We usually go together. We were wrapping up the day when I was approached by a woman, Carol. Don't know her last name. She asked me to look in on a girl she was sitting. She said the girl was sick. Kojo Omabo. This was Ashanique? Matilda Deacon. Yes. Kojo Omabo. And in your determination, was she sick? Pause. Matilda Deacon. Possibly. We talked for only a little while. I found her to be a very smart, very convincing young woman.
If she's mentally ill, I'm not sure what the diagnosis would be. It's too early to say.
Kojo Omabo. Do you think, Carol had a good reason to ask you to see Ashanique?
Matilda Deacon. Yes.
Kojo Omabo. You said she's not obviously mentally ill.
Matilda Deacon.
It's a complicated situation. Diagnoses like these take time. I would have to run a number of tests. This isn't like doing a swab and prescribing a pill. But, there is something very special about the girl.
Kojo Omabo. I understand. And you also met Janice, the mother, at this interview?
Matilda Deacon. Yes.
Kojo Omabo. I was told that the girl's babysitter, Mrs. Carol Malone, said Janice was not happy that you were talking to her daughter. She kicked you out?
Matilda Deacon. She was furious.
Kojo Omabo. Why do you think that was?
Matilda Deacon. I'm not really sure. At the time,
Kojo Omabo. But looking back, knowing what you know from the incident this morning, why do you think Janice Walters was so upset that you were talking to her daughter?
Matilda Deacon. She was involved in something. I can see that now. Ashanique was wrapped up in it. Not directly, but Janice was convinced that my talking to Ashanique had exposed her to some mortal danger. She was deeply paranoid.
Kojo Omabo. And that's why you told the other officers that Janice asked you to delete all the files related to Ashanique from your computer.
Matilda Deacon. Yes, I think so. She had a gun, too.
Kojo Omabo. Can you tell me what your relationship with Dr. Clark Liptak was?
Matilda Deacon. He was a colleague, my boss, in certain aspects. He oversaw a lot of the research I've been doing.
Kojo Omabo. And you got along? You weren't angry at him about anything?
Matilda Deacon. Not at all.
Pause.
Kojo Omabo.
I'm sorry. Do you need a tissue?
Matilda Deacon. No. I'm okay.
Kojo Omabo. And the man who killed him. Have you seen this man before?
Matilda Deacon. No, never.
Kojo Omabo. Thinking back. Do you recall him saying anything to either Janice or Ashanique?
Matilda Deacon. Like I told the officers. He only said one thing. He said, "Where's 51?
Kojo Omabo, does that mean anything to you?
Matilda Deacon. No.
Kojo Omabo. Do you think that this man had anything to do with Janice's paranoid statements? That perhaps this man was part of the conspiracy she was convinced was out to get her and Ashanique? Why she wanted names deleted from the university files?
Matilda Deacon. I don't know. It's possible. But that's your job, right? To find Janice. Find the killer.
Kojo Omabo. Yes, of course. And I take it very seriously.
Matilda Deacon. Ashanique needs to be admitted to the hospital, okay? Her mother was giving her an experimental cancer drug. I have no idea why. But she needs to be evaluated by a physician, kept under watch at the hospital.
Kojo Omabo. Social services is already involved. Some good, very caring people, trained for situations like these. We're going to take good care of her, doctor. If she needs medical attention, she'll get it.
Matilda Deacon. She does. Trust me. When can I see her again?
Can I come by this evening?
Kojo Omabo.
Let's talk about that later. I can see you and the girl have a bond, but after a thing like this, there is a lot to discuss.
Matilda Deacon. I understand. Please let me know when I can visit.
Kojo Omabo. Will do. Pause, as Detective Omabo writes something down.
Earlier you said there is something special about Ashanik. Why do you feel that way?
Matilda Deacon.
I don't know exactly. Like I said, she's a complicated case, but there's something unusual in her demeanor, in her understanding of her own condition. That sounds like academic speak, but I'd very much like to talk to her again.
Kojo Omabo. I'm leaving you my business card. Feel free to call me anytime, okay? If something comes up, if you remember something you wanted to mention, or you're worried, there will be an officer doing regular patrols near your residence for the next 40.
Matilda Deacon. You don't actually think.
Kojo Omabo. I want to take every precaution, okay?
Matilda Deacon.
Okay. Do you have... I don't know how to ask this without sounding cheesy, but...
Kojo Omabo. Leads. We're following up on everything we have. There are a lot of cameras in the university. We'll find this guy, okay? We'll get him.
Matilda Deacon.
There is one other thing.
Kojo Omabo. Okay.
Matilda Deacon.
The man who killed Clark. He winked.
Kojo Omabo.
Winked?
Matilda Deacon.
Yes.
Kojo Omabo.
He winked at you.
Matilda Deacon.
Yes. After he killed... Why? Why do you think he would have done that? I've never seen him.
Kojo Omabo.
I don't know, Dr. Deacon. I don't know.
27. 12:30 p.m., December 12, 1761. Troitsky Estate, Moscow, Russian Empire. Snow falls on the elm trees lining the entrance to the vast Troitsky Estate. Smoke curls from the squat chimneys of the numerous thatched houses that border the estate. Despite the high humidity and the numbing cold, peasants from the villages around Troitsky are working their fields, their tools scratching at the cold soil to prepare it for spring. In a field, workhorses whinny. A dog's bark pierces the brutal sky. Every living thing knows the coming winter will be harsh. There is movement along the road to the estate. A carriage, ornate in its decorative elements, speeds toward the massive main house. The driver is a narrow-shouldered man, with a face beaten by scars. Inside the carriage, a single occupant. Darya Nikolaevna Soltikova is 28 and resplendent in royal garb. She was widowed 2 years ago when her husband Gleb died. Though he left her the wealthiest widow in the empire, she never really loved him. She was just a child when they were married, and she found him, the nobleman, cold. He was always brusque with his advances, never touching her, never kissing her, just forcing her legs apart and using her the way he used the village whores. He was nothing like Nicholas. Nicholas appreciated her. He read her poetry and tasted her sex. Before Nicholas, she was a ghost, an empty woman haunting her own life, a shadow trailing behind her sons. Nicholas brought her to life. For the first time, she felt a passion for something, a hunger that only he satisfied. It was wicked, and she knew it. When they were together, her flesh became frenzied. Her sex throbbed and burned. She needed to consume him entirely, to pull him so close that they would merge, melting into each other the way a steel bar vanishes into the smelter's pot. But Nicholas is gone. Gone 5 months now. Run off with the girl. The one with the full lips that all the servants gossiped over. She was 17 and her body was taut. Nicholas was supposed to die. The cunt was supposed to bleed at his feet before he was set alight. It didn't happen. Her servants failed. And now Nicholas and his child bride were as far away as St. Petersburg or Paris. When Darya had learned of his infidelity,
She fell to the floor of her sitting room. Her eyes rolled into her skull and her mouth spat, and her limbs writhed like serpents. Daria's closest servant ran for the physician, who later diagnosed her with the shaking disease. It was born of ill humors, so he bled her. For 2 days and nights, she lay in bed with leeches growing like blackberries on her arms. Then came the honey and the vodka. Daria was sick, vomiting every few hours for another 2 days. Though she recovered, she was not the same. The seizures had broken something inside her body. She thought of a large clock, its insides so complex and everything about it perfectly weighted and balanced. If just one gear were to shift, the whole thing would be off. A gear had shifted within Daria. Even now, 5 months later, Daria thinks of Nicholas and the lust returns. There is a heartbeat between her legs. As the carriage bumps along the road, jostling her, she feels the heartbeat quicken. She knows she'll have to slack its thirst, and only blood can satisfy this fire. The Slavs have legends of blood drinkers. They call them Upuris, and say these unclean souls roam the countryside preying on people traveling alone or unfortunate enough to cross their paths. Daria does not believe in such fairy tales. Her need is not supernatural. For her, blood is power. Pain is pleasure. She scans the passing fields. Many peasant girls work the soil. Most of them are thick creatures made heavy by toil. But there is one girl, with glossy red hair, leading a goat along the elm trees. She is singing. Daria tells the coachman to stop the carriage immediately. He obeys. He has done this many times before. Seeing Daria, the girl pulls the goat closer and stops her singing. Daria opens the carriage door and leans out.
Hello. Do you know who I am?
The girl shy hangs her head. The goat bleeds.
Come now. Don't be shy. You are the mistress,
the redhead girl says,
from the estate.
Daria smiles.
I have need for a new servant girl. Someone to care for the animals. Do you love your goat? I have many that need caring for. You should come to the house with me. Over lunch, we will discuss the animals. I love them dearly, but I have had so much trouble finding someone whose heart is as pure as yours. I need someone to sing to them and show them love. Does that sound like something you would enjoy?
The redhead girl glances back over the fields.
Yes, she says, turning to Daria. That sounds beautiful. Excellent. Tie your goat to a tree. I won't keep you long. We will go and sup at my house, and you can tell me of the songs you like to sing. I may be a widow, but I am not that much older than you. Most of my servants are hags. They don't care about singing or animals. I long for a friend to share my passions.
The peasant girl ties her goat to the nearest elm tree and pats it on the head. She whispers something in its ear. The goat bleats before turning to the grass at its feet. With the scarred coachman's assistance, the redhead girl climbs into the carriage and sits down beside Daria. As the coach lurches into motion, the girl looks down at her filthy clothes. Daria notices and leans forward and pats the girl on the knee.
Don't worry, Daria says. We'll get you cleaned up. Tell me your name.
Lilia,
the girl says. The ride to the house takes another 27 minutes. During that time, Lilia sings the folk stories her mother taught her. Her voice is good. It's high-pitched and ethereal, and fills the interior of the carriage. The coachman weeps silently, hearing the red-haired girl's voice. At the house, the coachman stops the carriage and opens the door for Daria and her companion. A coterie of servants greets them at the stairs. Once inside, hot tea is poured and incense is burned. Daria knows Lilia has never seen such wealth. She stands in the enormous house's foyer, staring up at walls that seem to rise into the very sky. Paintings hang in abundance. 1,000 gold and silver candles burn in glistening chandeliers. An army of servants stands at the ready, their eyes cast at the red-haired girl's feet.
I have a music room,
Daria tells the girl.
Do you want to see it?
Daria leads her down a long corridor to a staircase that descends into the very earth. In the basement, torches burn and light dances on the arched ceiling. Daria shows the girl to a small room, and she steps inside with a smile that quickly disappears. The room is empty, with only a drain in the center of the floor. No music books, no instruments. Lilia turns around. There is confusion on her pretty face, but it soon gives way to fear. Daria knows what Lilia sees in her eyes. Cornered, Lilia screams and claws the wall behind her. Daria closes the door. She pulls a fire poker from a rack on the wall and strikes the girl, beating her until the skin of her palms tears and Lilia's back is split open, her white spine gleaming. The murder is over in only a matter of seconds. Daria drops the fire poker to the floor, and then, her arms and legs shaking with an orgasmic pulse, she opens the door to the room. Her servants are waiting. They come into the room with towels and buckets. Satiated, Daria walks slowly back upstairs to one of the palace's showers. There, standing on the ornately tiled floor, she allows her servants to undress her. Then, stepping onto stools so they stand above her, the servants wring the bloody towels over Daria's face and arms. She bathes in the coagulating blood, moaning in ecstasy, soaking up the intense cocktail of chemicals bathing her brain. Daria closes her eyes. 28. 10:23 a.m., November 14, 2018. Fountain Lake Apartments, Vernon Hills, Illinois. When Daria's eyes opened, they were Raid's eyes. The same bottomless black, the same alien gaze. Raid splashed water on his face and leaned in close to the bathroom mirror, the only finished bathroom in the entire apartment complex, and stared through the protective plastic, warping his image. He noticed that he had missed a hair, a tiny, fragile thing, barely the length of an aphid's antenna, on the left corner of his upper lip. Raid considered taking off his gloves and plucking it by hand, but didn't want to risk having the hair break off. That would be a pain, and he'd make a mess of his skin if he went digging for it later. Fuck. Goddamn body was always fighting back. Even as close as he was, even with his power at a monumental swell, he was being fucked with. As Raid walked back to the bedroom where Janice waited, he considered undressing her. He liked the way her shirt hugged her chest, the way her breasts ballooned up and over the top of her bra. When he was tying her up, he watched them wobble beneath the fabric of her shirt. Globules, like one would see floating effortlessly in a lava lamp. His body was desperate for the shimmering warmth that flooded his legs when he ejaculated. When he released, the surge of endorphins and dopamine made the animal he'd beaten into submission cry with joy. He had to admit, he'd indulged his body before.
Such decadence. Such deliciousness.
Stepping into a bedroom, Raid found Janice exactly as he left her, strapped with zip ties to a straight-back chair. She had run from the pharmacy during their shootout. He tracked her easily, though, and caught her in a parking garage at the university. She tried to shoot him after he'd found her trying to hotwire a Prius, but she was too slow, too emotional, and he got the gun from her and sucker-punched her into unconsciousness. 20 years of looking, and it was as easy as that. Knocked out, Janice's head hit the steering wheel. The horn blared before he dragged her out toward his rental car. It was sloppy work, nothing he was particularly proud of, but his body had been quite excited. It was a thrilling moment. The bedroom was on the second floor of an unfinished house. It stood on the edge of a brand new development. Most of the houses were skeletal, their yards just rectangles of dry dirt. Tiny sprigs of trees had been planted in the yards. One day, Reid imagined, this might be a beautiful place, and the family who lived in the house would never know how much of Janice's blood had soaked into its floors. Looking Janice over, Reid let his brain wander back through the fields of his memory. There were so many bodies there. He remembered fumbling in darkness on rain-soaked soil. His shape was hairier, 200 generations back, his limbs shorter and knotted with muscle. And his mind was a thing of simplicity, driven solely by the basest needs, to fill his gullet and fuck his balls empty. A few lives ago, as a young girl, he toyed with his genitals endlessly. He could never scratch a desperate itch. Her clitoris and labia were singed off by her grandmother in a strange ritual. Beyond that, the memories continued to tumble fast and loose. There were the mother and daughter whores in London who stank of spoiled milk. He drank up their scent as he sodomized them together. One with his cock, the other with a fat carrot that the mother had delicately chiseled into the shape of a phallus. There was the young African man who sucked on his cock with a violence he'd never before experienced. His previous self killed the man and wore his teeth around his neck. That blood, that power. It was Raid's true first taste of destruction. The ensuing addiction coursed through Daria and the lives that followed. Over a dozen lives. He ripped writhing bodies, pissed into the mouth of a fat woman with inverted nipples, and drank the blood of a Scandinavian prince, waking up with clotted blood matted in his pubic hair. Standing across from Janice, Reid inhaled the stale, cedar-scented air of the bedroom and let the memories fade away. He was not frequently given to nostalgia, though his body still enjoyed the queasy frisson of those memories. He largely found them quaint now, the dreams of a beast. As much as his flesh still wanted to quiver and cheat, he liked to believe he no longer fell for its tricks and illusions.
No, I won't touch Janice's body with desire. I'll touch it with hate.
Reid pulled off his rubber gloves, tossed them to the floor, then tugged a new pair from his back pocket and put them on slowly. His eyes were glued to Janice's as he took off his hoodie, folded it carefully, and placed it on a gray athletic duffel bag on the floor under a cheap card table.
Before you escaped, Reid said, you told me you'd do everything you could to cure me, like you were a doctor or something. How funny. I believed you. I was going to run too, but then I saw it.
He paused. Then, shaking his head, he said,
I saw that same ruthlessness. You are truly your mother's daughter, more than you could ever imagine.
Janice said nothing, her expression stone-faced. Reid walked around her, the lighting touching her shoulders.
Back then I felt abandoned, lost in this world. It took time, but I came to realize that was for the best. Staying with the team distilled me. And now we've come full circle. You're the one who's been abandoned.
Back at the card table, Reid pulled a laptop from the duffel bag. He set it up on the table, logged into Skype, and then turned the laptop around to face Janice. On the screen were four open windows stacked neatly in a row, faces appearing in each. Two men and two women, three of them in their mid-60s. One woman was younger, possibly 40. They all wore business attire. The woman on the far right of the screen had thin blonde hair pulled into a ponytail. She had green eyes and skin the golden color of lightly toasted bread. The woman was framed by a window through which a hazy sky was visible. She toyed with an exceedingly expensive Aurora 88 Cigarro Limited Edition fountain pen. Reid took his place standing behind the table as if at attention.
Dr. Sykes, he said, if you could begin.
The blonde woman looked directly at Janice.
It's good to see you. You look well.
Janice ignored her. Dr. Sykes twirled her pen and said, "Let's begin, Raid." Raid removed a leather kit from the duffel bag. Inside were hypodermic needles and syringes. He carefully filled a syringe with a clear liquid from a small glass bottle with a rubber stopper. Then he walked over to Janice, carefully inspected the inside crease of her right arm, and injected the clear liquid into her accessory cephalic vein. Janice didn't thrash. She didn't fight. Janice had spent the last 20 years running from this moment. She trained every nerve fiber in her body to resist what would come next, and mentally walked herself through the worst pain imaginable, envisioning steel cutting, pliers pulling, hammers breaking, chemicals burning, and rope strangling. Janice knew that Raid would be the perfect torturer. She insisted on being his most imperfect victim. 17 seconds passed before Raid turned to the laptop. He nodded to those assembled. The show was about to begin. 29. As Raid began to remove items from his black leather kit, Janice angled her head as best as she could to see what he would be using. Scalpels, knives, awls, augers, specialized surgical instruments. But the last thing Raid removed from the briefcase was a cheese grater, the kind sold in stores catering to high-end chefs and most discerning foodies. The cheese grater was encased in a plastic sleeve to protect blades that Janice could only assume were exquisitely, beautifully sharp. Raid walked over to Janice, the grater tight in the grip of his right hand.
"I need the solution," he said. Janice spoke for the first time.
"No.
I have all the skills you have. I know all the same escape techniques, the same survival strategies. I want you to make this easy. For me. If you give it to me, I will cut your throat. It will hurt, but not for long. Not compared to the alternative. If you don't give me the solution, I'll have to open you up to get it."
Tears rolled down Janice's cheeks before she knew it.
"God damn it," she thought. "Already? You need to be strong, girl. You need to show him he can't scare you. Don't want him getting off on this."
"The solution," Raid said again.
"No."
Raid slowly slid the cover off the cheese grater. Then, stepping next to Janice, he placed the cold metal against the warm skin on her forearm. He wasn't sweating. She imagined his heart rate hadn't increased by a single beat.
"We didn't abandon you," Janice said.
Raid met Janice's gaze.
"We didn't," she continued. "We would never have forgotten you."
On the laptop, one of the women cleared her throat. The signal was clear. Keep going, don't stop. This must be done, and done now. Raid momentarily closed his eyes. Janice wanted to imagine he paused because there was still an emotional feeling person at his core. He hadn't been totally erased. Of course, she figured, she was wrong.
"Do not hold out hope, girl. Can't have no faith in hope. Tell me the solution."
Janice, her skin flushed, her nose running, eyes bloodshot, shook her head in defiance. She stared down the blurry faces on the laptop, sending them every ounce of hatred and rage she could hold in her gaze. She willed it to wither their souls.
"Fine," Raid said. "Fine."
Raid had used the grater before. He saw the art in what it could do. It was a simple tool, yet it was capable of unimaginable horrors. Watching someone's skin curl up through the grater's notches never ceased to amaze him. When the grater slid across Janice's flesh, she howled. Her screams bounced off the walls like a car crash in an echo chamber. Raid ignored it, kept working. When he'd removed enough of the first three layers of flesh, enough to see the fat globules and muscles underneath, Raid emptied a vial of silver nitrate onto her arm. Then he stepped back from his work and looked upon it. His hands, his forearms, and shirt were soaked with blood. Janice coughed and spat, the thin drool dripping down her chin. Without looking up, she said, "When I had my little girl, I pushed for 4 hours straight with no meds. Not even a single Tylenol. I can push through this. I can push through anything you do to me. Long enough to make you understand, I won't break."
So Raid got back to work. Over the next 5 minutes, he carved through muscle down to bone. He went slowly, enjoying the way the fat bubbled up through the grooves and the muscle curled tight. When he hit bone, he began shaving it down. Janice passed out. He woke her with smelling salts from his kit. When she woke, Janice said,
"You're being lied to."
Her voice was now a pale flicker. Raid lowered the grater. He could see his reflection in the pool of blood on the floor beneath the chair. He got close, placing his ear a few inches from Janice's mouth. She wanted to bite his ear off, but she knew she didn't have the strength to move her neck. Besides, her words would be more powerful.
"They're lying,"
Janice repeated.
"Of course they are," Raid said. "That's never changed."
Turn off the computer. I'll tell you."
"Tell me what?"
He leaned in even closer. Over the weirdly antiseptic scent of fresh blood and raw flesh, she could smell Raid's antiperspirant. Floral hints, something citrus, something earthy.
"What she's hiding from you?"
"She?"
"Dr. Sykes."
Raid stepped backward to the table and, still facing Janice, reached around and closed the laptop. He then removed a syringe from his kit. Then, crouching down in front of her, Raid prepped the needle and found a vein on Janice's right hand. One he hadn't gotten to yet with the grater. He injected her.
"Painkillers and non-epinephrine," he said.
Then he said,
"Talk."
Janice gave the drugs a few seconds to infuse her system. The heaviness in her head lifted, the fog in her eyes cleared. She met Raid's cold gaze with a glacial stare that suggested nothing of her former self remained.
"They built a new accelerator,"
Janice said.
"They won't tell you it works, but it does. And I can get you in. You can be fixed. No more medication, no more torture and death, no more being their tool."
Raid cocked his head like a dog, curious. Seeing his interest, Janice continued, making her mouth form words, though her throat felt as though it were collapsing in on itself.
"The machine is only a few miles away. It went online a few months ago. You ensure my daughter is treated and released, and I will tell you where it is.
Give me the solution, and we'll go there now," Raid said.
"No, not unless we have a deal."
Exploding into motion, Raid grabbed Janice's hair and wrenched her head back. It happened too quickly for her to scream, though the pain that shuddered through her body had shredded nearly all her resolve.
"I don't make deals," Raid said. "Tell me, and I'll make sure this ends quickly. That's all I can offer. Nothing more."
Janice grimaced, her vision swimming, her skull in a vice.
"Fine,"
she whispered. Raid let her go. Janice's head flopped down, her chin banging into her chest hard enough that she bit her tongue. The dull, penny taste of blood was instantaneous. Raid walked over to the card table and opened up the laptop again. He leaned the screen back as far as it would go to see the windows, and their digitized faces click back into focus.
"Everything okay?"
Dr. Sykes asked.
"Listen,"
Raid said. The laptop was turned to face Janice.
51, he said. "Give them the solution."
Janice closed her eyes and recentered. Then, with a broken sigh, she recited a long series of numbers and letters, a formula. The solution. Raid listened to it dispassionately as the heads on the laptop scribbled it all down, Smiles spread across their faces simultaneously. Finished. Janice looked up at Raid.
I forgive you,
she said.
And what's that supposed to mean?
Raid asked.
You can't help what you are.
Raid pulled a filleting knife from his kit under the card table. Janice knew what it meant. The pain gnawing at the back of her brain, the stiffness in her limbs, all of it would come to an end soon. As Raid approached, Janice looked beyond him, beyond the faces on the laptop at the wall. It dissolved away, and Ashanik's smiling face materialized there. Janice laughed to herself, remembering how her daughter would dance in front of the mirror, wearing a scarf and sunglasses. Each little movement sent a jagged cascade of pain through her body. But each was worth it. While Raid's cocktail might have worn off, the endorphins that flooded Janice's body more than masked the pain. Seeing Ashanik, feeling her daughter's warmth, she was at peace. Janice said,
I see back a million years. My line continues.
Knowing he'd already lost her, Raid stepped toward Janice, and without hesitation, he slashed her throat in a clean line. Before the blood frothed out of the wound, Janice mouthed something. It was not meant for Raid, but the people, the lives Janice saw beyond him. The walls of the apartment building dissolved away like sugar in water. The sun rose overhead, and Janice could hear the ocean wave rise, crest, and fall of cicada calls. Raid could not hear it. He did not need to.
This is where you end,
he whispered. 30. 3:57 p.m. 1.5 million years ago. Lower Paleolithic, Eastern African continent. The sound of the cicadas is deafening. It rises and falls like ocean swells, sweeping across the savanna, intermingling with the chatter of bird calls and the grunts of grazing wildebeest. The sun hangs directly overhead. In the far distance, just over the mountains, the patriarch notices a thunderstorm. It will rain tonight, and he will need to move his family into the forests that surround the savanna. A lion roars as the cicadas start up again. The patriarch's family is sprawled in the shade at the base of a baobab tree, its massive branches sweeping over the red dirt and small thorny bushes. The matriarch to his left, her narrowed eyes are trained on the sunlit grasslands. Sitting in her lap is their youngest, a child of no more than 8, napping, her eyes rolling under her eyelids. To his right, his oldest son, a young man with long legs and a scarred left hand, sharpens a flake blade with a river stone. The young man's wife, a lithe girl with a dark stripe painted across her eyes, sleeps. Their children, toddlers, toy distractedly with the long-ago abandoned shell of a tortoise. They have walked for 15 days straight following the herds. At the base of the mountains, where the rivers were at their wildest, the family hunted deer and boar. In the early evenings, when the moon was at its largest, the family swam in a shallow pool, teeming with small fish and frogs. Now in the buzzing heat, the patriarch licks his lips, recalling the sweet taste of the water. He thinks over the route they'll take south through the river basin before swinging back toward the northern forests. He plans to bring his family to the shallow pool again. Even if it means a day less on the savanna, a day less hunting, he knows it would be good for them. They have never felt as close, as much a family as they did sleeping beside the pool. The cicadas stop their relentless buzzing. The savanna is silent. The wildebeest and elephant look up instantly, attuned to something the patriarch cannot hear. But he knows predators have moved in close. He grips his spear, fingers moving on the smooth surface. The matriarch stirs beside him, leaning forward to better watch the swaying grass. Seconds later, the elephant and the wildebeest lower their heads and feed again. The danger they sensed has passed. The cicadas start back up. The patriarch sighs and leans against the trunk of the baobab.
As he does, he places his hand on the small of the matriarch's back, runs his fingers along the dull scars that dot her skin. He likes the feel of them. Small, soft mountain ranges and valleys. Still watching the savannah, the matriarch shakes a handful of dried berries from a small leather pouch she wears around her ankle. She chews them thoughtfully, enjoying the touch of the patriarch. They have been together for 20 years now. She recalls the birth of their first daughter. The matriarch was in labor for 2 days, crouched and moaning beside a fire, while the patriarch rubbed smoothing clay on her back. The baby was stillborn, and she recalls crying silently after they'd buried the tiny body. The patriarch peeled the dried clay from her back, tossing it into the guttering fire, and then they moved on. Chewing the leathery berries, the matriarch takes her eyes from the savannah for a brief moment to look down at the face of her sleeping child. The youngster awoke before dawn, crying and afraid. She could not explain why, but the matriarch understands that the visions during sleep are often frightening. She is eager to soothe the little one again. The patriarch looks beyond the horizon. He imagines he sees many things in that gambling haze. Animals, people, faces of loved ones, faces of those who have died. A breeze rustles the leaves above his head. The branches sway. It brings a cool sensation that sweeps over the patriarch's face and shoulders. He closes his eyes, one with the moment.